Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at Carriage Works at the 2018 Festival.
Well, hello. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Hello. I see many of you are on your 19th coffees for the day. Well done. That's admirable. So am I. Hello. My name is Richard Feidler. I'm a presenter and an author. With ABC Radio, I present Conversations. And my guest is the extraordinary Maria Tumarkin. Now, Maria is the author of several books. Her most recent one is Axiomatic. Would you mind holding that up? The product placement shot there, ladies and gentlemen. There we are. It's described as part reportage, or should that be reportage? I don't know. Part philosophical meditation and part storytelling. It looks at conventional wisdom about the role of the past in shaping the present. It's a book that deals with five axioms that go from truisms to cliches to old bits of wisdom, including time heals all wounds, history repeats itself, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it, give me a child before the age of seven and I'll give you the woman, and you can't enter the same river twice. Maria's prose is urgent and fabulous and experimental and passionate and thoughtful and fabulously interesting. And I'm just going to quote Helen Garner herself writing about Maria's writing. She says, "No one can write like Maria Tumarkin. She charges headlong into the worst and best of us, with an iron refusal to soften or decorate. Sentences bare of artifice, stripped back to the bone, to the nerve, fired by raging grief and love." Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Maria Tumarkin.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can you quit writing now that Helen Garner has said
yes,
that?
Yes, I can quit writing and I can die.
Okay. I'm still waiting for that from Helen. She's not said that about my writing yet, but I can only live in hope. Given that so much of your writing, Maria, is about memory and the past and how slippery those ideas are and how you remember things, we have to talk about your own past. So much of your writing is about that. Tell me about the city you grew up in, please.
So I grew up in Ukraine, in the eastern part of Ukraine, in the second largest city, Kharkov. My mom was from Kiev, which is the capital of Ukraine. My parents are cousins. That could explain a few abnormalities that have been passed on through generations. My father pursued my mother with great urgency. Perhaps I inherited that urgency from him. She withstood his advances for 7 years and then just gave in.
Seven years?
Yes. And out of that siege, my sister and I were born. But sorry, you asked me about the city, and here I am talking about my parents. So a big industrial city, and of course now it's very close to the bits of Ukraine that are in the news, where Russian soldiers pretending not to be Russian soldiers are at war with Ukrainian soldiers, something that would have been completely inconceivable as I was growing up, or even, you know, 5-6 years ago. And that's that kind of the eastern part of Ukraine, very close to Russia. I didn't speak Ukrainian, to my shame. In fact, I had a friend of my sister who was a doctor, a young doctor, give me a certificate excusing me from studying Ukrainian for medical reasons.
So you grew up speaking Russian then?
Grew up speaking Russian, believing in the kind of the grand Russian language, Russian literature, believing that Ukrainian was a kind of a
second-rate language.
Yeah, second-rate.
Yeah, absolutely. So Russian is the language of Pushkin,
Dostoevsky. Yeah, absolutely.
We said that exactly at the same time. Yeah, did you notice that?
Yeah, your accent was perfect.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. When this is, of course, the final years of the Soviet Union that you grew up in that part of Ukraine. When you sort of think of your old apartment that you grew up in, what do you see? How do you describe that?
I think what I see mainly is the kitchen. And there is a Russian expression that I think has kind of traveled and become a little bit of an kind of international thought, kitchen conversations. And they're the kinds of conversations you can't have anywhere else. They're the most intense, the most raw, the most intellectual, the most deep, the most perhaps subversive. as well. And I think it was really at the center of our life. And it was a tiny kitchen. And now that I have been spoiled by my life in Australia, I just think even, you know, one person and a door couldn't fit in that kitchen. But we could feed like 8 people just sitting on each other. And there was, you know, and there were other spaces. Why did we congregate there? There was just something there. And it's not just about food and the importance of food and in a kind of, you know, cultural transmission. There was just something. Maybe it felt like the safest place as well, where you could have like the most incredible conversations. But Robert Desay, you know, many people would know him, of course. You know, he talks about the kinds of conversations that he had in Russia that he has not been able to have anywhere else. And I think most of them happened in various kitchens in his life.
Most of us in Australia are used to that thing of you grow up in a suburban house, perhaps, in a quarter-acre block. Yep. How different is privacy, the idea of privacy, and amongst where you lived, amongst the people you grew up with?
Privacy was a bourgeois invention. It did not exist. Homosexuality did not exist either. there was no privacy. In a sense, you know, you lived in an apartment block. There were, you know, people everywhere. You could hear your neighbours, you know, taking showers, and often those showers would go through the ceiling and end up partially in your apartment. Every single child who was practising a musical instrument was, you know, in front of you within your sort of range of hearing and part of your life. Women opening windows and screaming to their children, "Dina!" You know, all of that. So you kind of lived in a kind of vocal soup of all the other families, and you were part of it. But of course, you know, within your apartment, there were kind of pockets of privacy that you could maintain. You know, you could. I did not have a room of my own, but I had a bed in our lounge room, which gave me an opportunity, because I had to go to bed at 9, but that was the place where the television was. All the good movies were at 9:30. I was told to turn my back away from television and sleep while those movies were viewed, but I could, you know, I could really kind of, you know, listen to what was happening. And
how does that affect you when you grow up in such close proximity, where you've seen all your neighbours in their underpants, essentially?
You do see them, especially men.
Men?
Women are a bit more circumspect, okay. But men's, yeah.
You see, when you live in that close proximity, how does that adjust the way you are in the world? Do you then just have to learn to just to block out the kid playing the bad violin, the neighbour banging on the door, the scent of food coming out of the kitchen all the time? How do you then have an inner life in that kind of world?
I think it's, I don't know if people have this experience, sometimes you can go to a cafe which is really noisy, and because you have to block out the noise, you can actually have the most intense experience of privacy. When you're working, you can really create a zone of force field around yourself. So in fact, it's not antithetical, that kind of crazy coexistence with, you know, like sardines in a can, to use that cliche. It's actually not kind of antithetical to the development of a rich interior life. You just have to work much harder at it, because you have to kind of constantly be pushing the world back and say, no, this is my space, the space for my thoughts and feelings, the space for my silence. But it's possible. It's possible. And people in countries across the world who don't have a choice and who have human, you know, human beings coming at them, you know, at all hours and, you know, in all spaces, they have incredible kind of interior life. It is possible, absolutely.
It was often said in the Soviet Union that women ran everything, and because they had to. Because the blight of alcoholism, or whatever else was going on, or the frustration and the pointless nature of work sometimes, meant that women, in the end, it was left to women to run absolutely everything. How true is that?
Well, one thing that there were no kind of housewives. We didn't go through kind of 1950s with so many women, not working class women, but middle class women in Australia would have stayed home and would have suffered tremendously because they were kept at home. Women in the Soviet Union went to work and looked after children. You know, there was an expression, I am a horse and a bull, you know, I am a man and a woman. So you had to do everything.
Women would say that. Yeah.
There was a kind of like a folk saying. Women would do everything, but certainly the kind of the the top echelons of power were still men. I mean, we had a woman going to space. She was not the first to go, Valentina Tereshkova, but, you know, she did go. I think maybe after a dog, but nonetheless. So, you know, you had women who were in the workforce, and you also had women who, there was no kind of idea that women were nurses and teachers. And again, I'm thinking about Australia, and men were, you know, whatever.
Managers and doctors,
etc. So there was, you know, many, many women went into the technical professions. My mom is an engineer. My aunt is an engineer. It was like the most normal thing to be for a woman. It wasn't remarkable. It was profoundly unremarkable. So in some ways, there was that kind of level of emancipation that, you know, the communist propaganda would have spoken about, because women were there. But then, of course, they had to go back home and they had to do everything at home. And then if their husbands were incapacitated in some ways, often through alcohol, but I don't want to partake in stereotypes, but, you know, it was there, you know, they had to deal with that as well. So often women will talk about, you know, their husbands as children, but that's not unusual. I think it's a global phenomenon.
you write that you and your mother are very, very close, and your mum is really kind and sweet to you. She only ever hurt your feelings once, you said, when she said to you, your sister was right, demons do lurk in quiet ponds.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Were you a quiet pond?
I was a quiet pond. I was silent. I was convinced from the age of 7 that I was more intelligent than all the adults in the room. I did not judge them. I pitied them. I pitied their follies. I pitied their inflated egos. And I kept to myself. And I remember this moment. I still can't quite understand why I did that. But my father actually took me to a shop, which was quite unusual, and he told me to pick a toy. And I desperately, desperately wanted a toy, any toy, like anything, you know, randomly picked would have been a great, great thing, you know, would have transformed my life. And I said no, because, you know, why did I need to say no? And my father's, you know, beautiful man, so there was absolutely no antagonism or no desire.
What did you say no?
Well, exactly, Richard, you tell me. Why did I say no?
Because you were too grown up for toys?
No, because I wanted to, you know, to be able to resist pleasures or temptations or to transcend the kind of the material existence. I don't know. But it wasn't about him, it was about me and the world. And it's like the ability to say no to a kind of a very unusual gift.
I'm above all that.
Maybe I am above.
Above the longing for Mattel Barbie or whatever the Soviet equivalent of that was.
That's right.
At the time.
Yes, yes. It was not quite a Barbie, but yes, it was.
I'm sure it wasn't, no. Why did your parents want to leave? Because I think you left it, what, 1989?
Yeah, yeah.
Just before the Berlin Wall came down?
Just months after.
Just months after,
yeah,
okay.
So we were...
Just at the end of 89.
We left in December, exactly,
okay.
Yeah.
So what made your parents want to leave?
So things were... I mean, at the time, no one could have predicted that the Soviet Union was going to collapse.
No one was predicting it at all. Even after the Berlin Wall fell, they said, well, that's the end of Eastern European communism, but the Soviet Union, that's going to endure for however many decades. Yeah.
I mean, the place felt completely monolithic. I mean, things were changing and there was definite turbulence. But so people, you know, I'm glad you said what you said, because there are some people now who claim to, you know, have the powers.
No
to
one
see.
Saw that. No one saw it coming. Well, not the CIA. Exactly. No one. No one.
There
did.
You go. Yeah. Yeah. So I think for my parents, it was actually about us being Jewish, secular, godless Jews. Now translated to the Australian context as bad Jews, like not following any traditions, not doing the right thing, not transmitting knowledge to children. But I think they actually feared, because there was quite a lot of unrest in the Ukraine at the time. There was a strong nationalist movement emerging around 89. It was happening in the Balkan states as well. And every time... there's that kind of upsurge of national pride. With it came anti-Semitism. You know, it's just much as we loved Ukraine and wanted to see it independent, we also knew that the shadow of that, you know, and it will be haunted by anti-Semitism. And there were some signs as well. And, you know, there were talks of pogroms. Nothing really happened. But it was in the air. And I think my parents felt that it was actually unsafe, or maybe not unsafe yet, but it could very easily become unsafe quite soon.
Was there much Jewish culture in the house or Yiddish spoken at all?
No, just some choice swear words from my mom and my aunt.
What, like schlong, stup, kvetch, that
yeah,
sort of stuff?
Yeah, yeah, and I'm not going to try. It's all very enjoyable, juicy, but Great.
What did they want for you in migrating to Australia?
My father wanted me to run the country. Yeah, he still hasn't given up, so...
Never say never, Maria.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Big ambitions, but I mean, I guess he wanted me, and my sister left as well, but my sister never came to Australia. She ended up staying in Austria because we had to go through it. It was like a multi-step, you know, convoluted and protracted exodus on our part, and so she ended up staying in Austria. But I think they wanted us to be free, to have that freedom inside, not to be slaves, not to have the slave mentality, as they would put it, not to live in that kind of totalitarian world where no matter how much you try to cultivate the inner freedom, you're still unfree every moment of every day. And they wanted us to be safe. They wanted us to study what we wanted to study, to thrive and prosper, not in the material sense necessarily, but just, you know, travel the world. And they did not see that as possible in the country that they were leaving behind. And at the time, in 89, lots of people actually talked about, you know, the Soviet Union as a kind of a concentration camp, even though it was as free as it ever was, you know, for the whole period of 70 years at the time. But still, there was a sense of us being locked inside in this kind of place of profound and insidious unfreedom.
The other day I interviewed Masha Gessen again, and there's some similarities to her story insofar as Russian Jewish family.
The same name.
Same, Gessen.
No, Masha.
Oh, of course, Masha. Maria. Yeah. Masha Shof Maria, that's right.
Yeah.
And they migrated, I think, in 79. Mm. 1979. Masha was 15, I think. And she's often wondered about the alternative Masha that hadn't migrated. The Masha that stayed behind and kept her friends there and led another life.
Yeah.
Do you often wonder about that for yourself? I know it's a counterfactual proposition, but...
I like counterfactual propositions.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And I ended up in Australia, I ended up being a single parent, and I actually often thought about what it would have been like to be a single parent in the Soviet Union that became the former Soviet Union. And I think Australia is a fantastic country in which to be a single parent. I heartily recommend it. And I did think about, I was here, I was able to raise a child, do a PhD. No one was pitying me. No one felt like my life was over because I was like in this kind of catastrophic predicament. It was like completely uninteresting to anyone. And I often wondered what would have happened to me if I ended up as a young woman alone with a child, and whether it would have been the end of my grand literary ambitions, for instance, because you have to make a choice, maybe. So, I do kind of involve myself in those fantasies.
The other Maria is still living in Kharkov.
The other Maria suffers, but the other Maria also, you know, has incredible friends around her.
Yeah, the friends that she had since she was a kid.
Yeah.
You were what, 16 when you left?
15. 15. I turned 16 in Australia.
Man. 15-year-old. Yeah. I got a 15-year-old daughter. Oh, man. What were you like to be moved? Were you furious at being moved away from your friends to the other side of the world?
I was furious, but I did not feel like I had the luxury to show it. I didn't feel like I had the luxury to be an adolescent. You just had to grow up. I also learned that in immigration, it's not about you. It's about your family, and it's about the future generations. It's about the generations that are
not yet
born. Did
you have that perspective then, though? I mean, that's a very grown-up perspective to have, grown-up as you certainly were, knocking back toys and all that. But,
that's right. At the age of 7, I said no to toys. Imagine me at the age of 15. I was levitating. No, but I was all those things, but I also felt like And also we had nothing to eat. You know, we had $8 for the whole family per day. And if my mom wasn't such an amazing cook, it would have gotten pretty ugly. If I was cooking for the family for $8, you know, would have been noodles. No. You know, yeah. I think what happens in immigration is that the pressure on families is so intense that families start breaking. So we had a lot of that. So I felt that perhaps the luxury of being hugely emotional was not there. But then I caught up. I came to Australia, and then I felt like, okay, we are over it. Like
We're safe.
I handled it. Like I wasn't overly self-indulgent. And then it's like I started writing letters to my friends, rescue me. And here, you know, I'm writing in 91. You know, the country is collapsing around them, you know. And I felt entitled to tremendous self-pity. Must have been because I suppressed my self-pity at the time of migration. And I'm like, I walk around this desolate country, this wasteland, and, you know, the anguish is unstoppable. I try and try, but, you know, those letters are probably the most shameful documents I have ever produced. But, yeah, so I think the rage was there, but it had to wait.
How much English did you have when you arrived?
Oh, none. Absolutely. Like, we had a terrible English teacher at school. And, like, I don't know what she did to us. We recited, you know, hello, hello, good morning to you, hello, hello, so glad to see you. That was the extent of that. And then we studied because we had to go through Austria and Italy, and I studied a little bit of English in Italy with an Italian priest who taught, you know, Jewish emigres a little bit of English. But it was sort of really bizarre. But he introduced me to his version of Australian accent. So he would constantly say Tuesday instead of, you know, the kind of harder T.
Right, so Tuesday instead of Tuesday.
Yes, and that was a revelation.
Do we do that? I've only just noticed that.
No, that's
do we say
Italian
Tuesday?
Priests,
we don't, I
suppose
we do. Yeah, Tuesday. Tuesday. Everyone say it, please. 1, 2, 3. Yeah, there's the CH there, wasn't there? Yeah. Definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember George Brandis came into the studio once at the ABC and said Wednesday as Wednesday. Who on earth says Wednesday for the day in the middle of the week? So clearly you picked it up. You've done all right with the English language, I think it's fair to say.
It took me a while, though. It doesn't, yeah, it
do you remember when you at the Do you remember when you could finally make it work for you, when you could sort of like grab it and mould it and shape it and make and get things from it that you needed from it? Do you remember that?
It took probably 10 years because, you know, there are people who make mistakes in a foreign language, you know, and that's fine because they are understood, they communicated their point, and there are people who cannot sleep and they relieve that mistake time and time again. Guess which category I'm in. So I was really tormented, and I remember I went to Melbourne Uni and I did Bachelor of Arts there, and I remember sitting in tutorials and just dreading being called on to talk, and just, you know, the heart rate and the sweat and everything. And then, you know, if I was invited rather forcefully into the conversation and I would say something, and then it was just would be unbearable because every single way in which I misused English, and I loved English, absolutely, I still love it. And just, I felt like I was a vandal, I was vandalizing it. And so it wasn't like a happy story, you know, Maria arrives in the country, Maria picks up the language, Maria is a Rhodes scholar or something. It's like a decade, maybe, of just biting my lip and wishing I could just stay silent.
Your use of English, as I said, is fabulous. It's extraordinary. And such an original voice, the way you write with such, like I say, urgency and feeling and thought and all those things. And I'm conscious as I'm reading your work that it's your second language. And it reminds me of authors like Nabokov, for whom English was a second language, and Joseph Conrad, for whom English was a second language. Has that in any way stood in your way, it being a second language rather than your first?
Mm. Another guy I'm thinking about, and there are women, of course, is Alexander Hammond, who is a Bosnian writer, came to America, and what he does with English is incredible. So in that tradition of people from other languages reinventing English language in their prose. Yes, there's a kind of a there's an interesting trajectory to this, I guess, because initially, that kind of, I was really tormented every time I made a mistake. And when I started writing, I wrote poetry in Russian. I didn't try to write poetry in English. But when I started writing, I was so desperate to sound like a native, to pass, not to kind of reveal my credentials as a person from another language. And then I met a woman who ended up editing three of my books before Axiomatic, and her name is Sybil Nolan, and she's a journalist, and now she worked at Melbourne University Press, now she's an academic, and she said, you have an accent in your speech and you have an accent in your writing, and you don't want to kill it, like you don't want it to go away. This is what you are doing. In fact, it's a great thing. It's not a bad thing. It's not a problem. It's not an obstacle. It's not a disability. And this was a great revelation because I felt that my understanding of English was very different, and what I wanted to do and the way I wanted to construct sentences was very different, but I didn't have the confidence to say no to all those stupid editors who tried to flatten me out and make me sound like, everyone else. I just felt like, okay, I have to kind of accept it, I guess. They're the native speakers and I'm not. And then emboldened by, what she said, I kind of started pushing back and saying, that's my English, that's what I'm doing with my language. And gradually, and now when I look at it, I just think, absolutely, think about all the diasporic languages that we have in Australia, all the community languages and all the Indigenous languages. They just should absolutely transform and contaminate English. English needs it. It's the most alive thing there is, language. And you need other things to bleed into it and shake it up and so forth. And I'm just a small little ant mounting the offensive.
I don't see you that way. I see you like English is not this crystalline cathedral. It's this great big sort of messy thing that's sticky and you can make holes in it and stretch it in all sorts of different directions. I suppose you just got past a point where you felt that English was this precious, fragile, delicate thing and something you could hit really hard and get interesting results out of it. Yeah. Is that what happened here?
Yeah, and also the idea that, yes, I will sound not like someone who was born in Australia or someone who was born in England. Yes, my sentences will have a different feeling to them, a different energy. They may even seem odd or strange or, they may inspire some kind of resistance in my readers. And I stand by that. I stand by the difference as well. And yes, so it is about kind of being able to hit the language and have that kind of really sort of relationship, but also just accepting that we do need people who write differently and who see English differently and who are, who can do different things to it as well. I mean, that's for the benefit of everyone. So I think it's about not kind of being ashamed about being like the poor cousin, oh, here I am from Eastern Europe, I can't speak your language, but coming in and saying, yes, I can speak your language and I can speak it in a way that is different and worthwhile for the difference.
Maybe Australia was a good country to come to. It took a long while for Australians to get comfortable speaking in our own voice, as Australians too. Like if I was an ABC presenter from 40 years ago, I'd say, here now, ladies and gentlemen, is Maria Tumarkin, the author of several splendid books. I'd be sounding like some British twit. But it took a long while for Australians to be comfortable with their own voices and their own accents. And hearing the kind of music that's in the Australian accent and the tenor and sound of that, because there's a kind of music in language and the cadence of that, and maybe that's what that is what you bring to your own work, Maria.
Yeah, I think so. And I think Australia is a place that I think, that doesn't have those rigid hierarchies. And you don't feel like 10 people are standing on top of you and reminding you of the tradition and the right way of doing things. There is freedom. I mean, you have to find it and claim it, but it's there. And it is, I'm sure, in a large way to do with the history, absolutely.
One of the reasons I was so keen to talk to you, apart from the quality of your writing, Maria, is you wrote a book called Otherland, which is the story of how you took your teenage daughter, Billy, with you back to Russia and to Ukraine so you could show her where you grew up. I wrote a book that was a not dissimilar mission. I took my own son with me in my book Ghost Empire to Rome and Istanbul so he could do this kind of coming-of-age trip and discover the later Roman Empire, the history of Byzantium together, particularly in Istanbul. And this was, for my story with him, was convened as a coming of age event, because Gentile Australians like me, we don't have a bar mitzvah, we don't have that kind of coming of age ceremony for our kids. And he loved history like I loved history. There was so much we didn't know and we still wanted to see, and we hadn't been to Istanbul. So that was the thing. It was a way of bringing us close together, but also a way of me being able to let him go as a little boy.
Because How old was he?
He was 14 at the time. How old was Billy when you took her with you to Russia and Ukraine?
Yeah, so she turned 12 on the trip. And I think 14 is probably a better age for that. Yeah.
Was that your intention, to treat that as a kind of a bar mitzvah or a coming of age thing, or a way of farewelling her childhood by taking her on this journey with you?
You know, it wasn't my intention. I think it's what it ended up being. But I think my intention was, I was a young parent by Australian standards, not by the rest of the world standards, but I had her when I was 21. I turned 22. And when you're young, you are ambitious. I was an ambitious parent, but I was kind of morally ambitious, right? I wanted to educate her, not in a sort of a maths and physics and so forth, although that was important. But I wanted her to be mensch,
worldly.
To be a person of fortitude and to be a person of integrity and honour. Exactly right. And I remember, I don't know if people have heard of Natalia Ginzburg. She's an Italian writer. And she wrote a book called The Little Virtues. It's a small book. It actually got republished just recently with the introduction by Rachel Cusk. And she talked about how petty our ambitions are for children, and how, in fact, instead of teaching them little virtues, we should teach them big virtues. So instead of, and understanding how to manage money, indifference to money, instead of caution, contempt for danger, instead of tact, empathy, and so forth. And I think I was really, it's the kind of... And I did feel, I love this country, but I did feel that there was a kind of... that the whole mission of parenting was banalified and trivialized in this country. It's like, no, I'm not interested. Like, it's so hard to be a parent. I'm not interested in making my child, competitive in a globalizing age and giving her opportunities or whatever. Like, it's just the work is too hard for me to do that. So I actually...
That's not the work of parenting, is it really? No, it's not to
lots
set
of
your kid out
like
with
the...
key performance indicators and with relevance to all key stakeholders in a globalising economy. No. I mean, our role as parents is to try and give them some moral foundations love and kind and all those things.
And perhaps I felt, and maybe I didn't see enough of that as explicitly kind of articulated. And I felt like, what is my role? What am I supposed to give her? And one of the things that I wanted to give her is that moral foundation. But also, my mom was born in Uzbekistan during the Second World War, in evacuation. They were from Ukraine. My daughter was born in Australia during Howard's era, right, in 1996. These are like... the distance between these worlds is really, really crazy, and I'm the meat or the pickle or the whatever soggy tomato in that sandwich. And what does that mean? And to me at the time, it meant that I needed to be the conduit for Billy to understand, where she comes from. So it is the ritual of taking your child back to the kind of, to the origins of your family or to the place where you are from. So in that sense, it was a ritual, but I wanted her to understand, where she came from, why she felt different, what it meant to be from, the part of the world that we were from. And I wanted, which was a terrible mistake and I paid for it dearly, I wanted her to have a transformative experience. So,
I wanted all these things as well. This is just so... I'm just going tick, tick, tick in my head as you're saying all these things.
Yeah.
One of the things that most delighted me about my son, pretty much as soon as he could talk, was that he was always asking questions about history to me. He was always trying to place himself in the great stream of events and people that had come before him. Or perhaps that was because he knew I loved it. And so he's trying to... engage with me by talking about the stuff
That's
I love.
A good way.
But yeah. I was so touched by that and moved by that and wanted to have those conversations. Mm. So let's go and do this thing. Let's have 1,000 years of the later Roman Empire together on this trip. At the same time, and I'm wondering if you had this concern yourself, I was worried I was being too overbearing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, behold, 1,000 years of history, son. Behold, you know. Like, it was. There's the great conservative philosopher, his name still lives me at the moment, who had a son quite late in life and said, I'm going to give my son the great Greek classics, the great Roman classics. I'm going to have him read the Sophocles and Aeschylus and all this stuff. And so the Guardian ran a campaign to have a whip round to buy the kid an Xbox, you know, instead. Were you worried you were being too overbearing in this? Like, look at all this suffering. Look at all this family history. I have to connect you to your grandmother.
Yeah.
Behold, my 12-year-old daughter.
I should have been worried about being overbearing. I started noticing things when Billy tried to walk in front of me or tried to distance herself from me in any way possible.
Like, no teenage girl has ever done that with a parent in the history of the world before.
Yeah, but not at the time when she's supposed to be transformed. Right? Like, that was very bad manners. But it's funny how deluded. I think I was swept up in this kind of mission.
Mm.
And also because Billy would talk to me quite a lot about not feeling like she was of this culture. So it was like, now you understand. This is why you're different. Inhale the air. You know, so terrible.
I see, Mother. I see now. I understand,
Can we go there and sit down? Mom, can we sit down? You know, do we have to go there and... She really resented me, but I was determined. The butting of head occurred on that trip, and I lost. She won.
You were both keeping diaries. Mm. What were your diary entries like when you compare the two?
Mine were profound. Hers were not. No, she. hers were actually quite interesting. I mean, I asked her to keep a diary, actually. So it was a little bit artificial because I did think that I could write, that I could possibly write a book about it, even though I decided during the trip not to think about writing a book because it would have felt very disingenuous for me to be reconnecting with my friends and people in my life and kind of thinking, oh, that's a really kind of, you know, a moment of great dramatic tension, you know. So I excluded it from kind of my consciousness. But the only thing that I did do is kept a diary and asked Billy to keep a diary. And then I didn't think about the book at all beyond that. So a lot of her diaries were, and I include some of them in other lands. The only thing that I did was spell check them. But other than that, like, all the kind of expression is there, it's hers. A lot of it was like, you know, dear reader, could you imagine what it was like to be dragged from one place to the next by your mother who's determined for you to, you know, oh, dear reader, I would rather be picking up cow droppings, frankly. But then there were things where she was connecting. But of course, you know, what happens when you want your child to have those experiences. Even if they're having a little bit of those experiences, they're not going to, they would rather die than show you. So some of those experiences were actually in the diary, where things were actually getting under her skin and she was feeling deeply, but, you know, the resentment.
I've paid good money to bring you here for an epiphany, young lady.
That's right.
Have your epiphany right now. Thank you.
Yeah.
You did take her back to your old apartment block.
Yes.
What was that like that day when you brought her into that block of flats where you kind of, you know, as a kid, you know every inch of that place you grow up in, don't you? Every square centimetre you know so well. What was that like being with her in that place again?
Well, one of the things that I kept talking to her about was this mythical place that I made mythical, see the earlier points about epiphanies and transformations. And to me, as a child, it was actually incredibly special, and it's the kind of rectangle that is formed by all the apartment block buildings, and it's the kind of the internal space, you know, as they kind of form whatever geometrical shape they form. And then you have that kind of safe space inside, and it's called dvor in Russian.
That's like the garden in the middle, is it?
Except there is no greenery. Right. There may be an occasional tree. There is a big Well, no, that's preempting what I'm going to tell you. Anyway, this is the place where children would spend countless hours kind of doing whatever. And of course, you know, it's, you know, for me, it was this incredible space of unsupervised exploration. And so, of course, you know, as Billy was growing up, I was telling her about this incredible place and all children for hours and hours, and their parents didn't know what they were doing, and it was, you know, a place of great kind of, you know, it was safe and yet it was wild, and, you know, and there was this community, but, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think she was most excited about that because she did kind of invest in that sort of whole construction. And then we came. And in fact, she wanted to go straight away to Dvor. It was just, you know, it couldn't get any more anticlimactic. There was like, and it was probably not that different to what it was during my childhood, but of course, I didn't remember that. There was like a huge pile of garbage sort of in the middle of it. It was just like concrete, an occasional sort of half-hearted tree, and just smelly, rotting garbage, and sort of, and no children at that moment, which I don't quite know. Maybe I think they were all at school. I think children would have been there at a different time in the day.
And were you watching her watch this with a sinking heart?
I was watching her sinking heart. Yes,
sinking
the heart was sinking. Yes, and then I kind of started apologising to her, and I felt like my credibility was well and truly shattered.
You wrote at the end of Otherland, "I recognise now that the real reason we went away together on our trip was so that we could come back and start learning how to live apart." Mm. This is what I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
That part of the way, reason why you write this kind of a book is to tell yourself not just how much but how you love that kid of yours, but also to reconcile yourself to the loss of their infancy, their childhood, and as you lose them to adolescence. There's a thing a Jewish friend of mine told me in Brisbane was that the bar mitzvah, the purpose of it is not for the kid. The kid gets a bike or whatever. The purpose of the bar mitzvah is for the parents. It's to actually to take them carefully through a grieving process of letting go of the kid in their lives and getting used to that, and then to adjust and enjoy the young adult that they're becoming. What do you think about that?
I think I felt that we were a unit. That was something that I discovered. I discovered that we were not. And it was my job to start backing down from her. And she was already taking very decisive steps away from me. But I had to be part of that dance. I had to be not, you know, she's trying to take a step away and I'm moving towards her. Come on, daughter, you know, come on, come closer. I actually
this is the kid you once held like that, you know?
Yeah.
You can't pick them up. You're not able to hold them like that anymore.
Yeah. And her autonomy, and if her choice was not to look at the buildings, not to read books about the Second World War, but to eat sushi in an overpriced Moscow restaurant. That's her choice as well. I was going to have less and less influence on those choices.
How old is she now? She's 21 now?
She's 21.
How does she talk about that trip now?
Oh, it's great. It was a fantastic trip. She didn't have to go and see a therapist after that. It's like, you know, it was, you know what happens. All those trips, you know, the longer you have, the more time you have, the more kind of wonderful they become. And that friction, wasn't it great for us, Mom? Wasn't it fantastic? We came to understand each other so much better. And yeah, so she's like totally not traumatized by it and doesn't bring it up as an example of one of my bad life choices. Like, there are other examples, but it's not one of them.
Well, this brings us to Axiomatic, your most recent book.
Because you think it's a bad life choice to write
a
book.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, a terrible life choice to write a book. when you say a life choice, you do mean life choice. How long did it take you to write Axiomatic?
Almost 9 years, and it's such a small book. Yeah, it's not a product placement, it's a demonstration of how small it is.
Why do you think it took so long to write this?
This is my fourth book, and I've never had this experience with any other book of mine, not that I've written 1,000, but I just felt that this book was cursed. And, you know, essentially this is a book about time, and I felt like I was constantly defeated by time. So when I would, you know, there are four, sorry, there are five sections, as you've mentioned. And when I would feel that one of them was complete, and, you know, what happens, like, I'm not, and I think I need to clarify that I take those five axioms or maxims or cliches or truisms or whatever we want, or pronouncements, and then, you know, it's not my, I'm not interested in defending or protesting it and saying, in fact, time doesn't heal all wounds, or, you know, we're not formed as children by the age of seven and so forth. You know, I have a really, really different intention. So I'm kind of, I try to open it up and try to kind of get in there and try to understand what does it tell us about, you know, the way we understand the relationship between the past and the present of us as individuals, you know, families, nations, etc. And I do that by kind of colliding these axiom with human life. That's not mine. So there
is the specifics of it. This is
the specifics of a human life, where I feel that there is something. So time heals all wounds. Looks at the at a young woman who lost her sister, who was only a year younger, to suicide. And you know, what does time do in the life of someone like her? And I meet her when she's 5 years from suicide, and then I continue to kind of spend time with her, and now she's 10 years, you know, or 11 years away from that event. What has time done to her, for her? And it's not about, you know, has she healed? Of course she hasn't, you know, but what has her life been like in the aftermath of this event? And she, in fact, found her sister and so forth. So she's kind of completely traumatized by that. So there is that kind of, you know, and I do that in every section where there is human life that is kind of alive and throbbing and unpredictable, and it kind of gets inside this axiom and kind of opens it up. And so to answer your question, I do remember, despite my advanced age, I do remember what you asked me. So I would finish, you know, one section, move on to the next, and then something would happen. You know, something would happen in the life of one of the people I was writing about, or something would happen in culture that I was actually talking about as well, because I don't only talk about individual lives, I talk about kind of cultural forces and changes and so forth. And so I would have to kind of, you know, start again.
And incorporate that new thing?
And incorporate this new thing, because the
book wouldn't be true. And would that change the trajectory then of that whole chapter?
And then the trajectory of the book as well. So, because, you know, they are kind of interlocked, even if not in an obvious way. So that was one thing. And another thing was that I would, because it took me so long, and there would be like a year or two in my life when I felt that it was too close to the bone, and some of the stuff that I was writing about, you know, grief and trauma and loss and naked human life and naked human soul, I just couldn't write about it. I was just, it hurt me too much, and I had to walk away, so there were breaks of that nature. But then there was something else which I do find amusing now, but it wasn't amusing at the time. I would sort of get to the end of the book, and because it would take so many years and take in all the kind of different things changing in the world and in people's lives, and then I would look at the first chapter and I would be like, no, I can't, this is embarrassing.
Who wrote this thing?
Exactly. And so I felt that every time I would get to the end of the book, I was already a different writer, the kind of writer who couldn't stand by some of the earlier sections. So I had to go and rewrite them. What happens when you do that? You get to the end and you're already a different writer. You know, you can't enter the same river twice, which is one of the axioms. But you can't make time stand still, right? But it was just constantly, I couldn't come to the point where I was telling the truth, I was honouring people's lives, I was the witness that I wanted to be, and I was not embarrassed of any of the chapters. They were true to me as a writer and as a human being. I just, like, things were not aligning. And so I just thought, it will never end. So this is very surreal.
It is.
You may need to pinch me.
It sounds like one of those great grand creative projects that happens to people every once in a while, which is launched with huge ambition and passion and intensity and fervour. But by the time you get to the end of the process, you just want to get a dagger and plunge it right into the heart of the thing and kill it stone dead.
Yeah.
So it can stop tormenting you.
Yeah.
Ultimately, what do you want to feel? Is that the word? Or know when you've finished a book? Once it's done, what makes it done? What makes you? What allows you to walk away from it then?
Well, with this book, I needed to know that I didn't injure anyone, that people I write about feel honoured and understood to the extent that another person can understand them. And I write about two Holocaust survivors. I write about, you know, there are human lives, incredible human lives in this book. And, you know, this book is my love letter to this woman I write about. So the idea that I got them wrong, or the idea that I just thought that I understood who they were and how they were shaped by all the events of their lives, but I didn't. That idea was kind of terrible. So that needed to happen. And of course, you know, you can never know, have I told the truth about someone who trusted me with their innermost kind of, you know, story. And I needed to know that I stood by every sentence. You know, every sentence had to be alive. You know, if there is dead wood in the book, then the book is dead. Like, even if you have five pages, then I think the whole book is compromised. So I needed each page to be alive, for steam to be, you know, and you talked about urgency, and I'm very grateful that you used that word. I wanted that sense of urgency. I wanted, you know, it's, you know, the stakes are high, and I just wanted that to feel like that on every page of the book.
It does feel like that. It feels like you sort of run into the pulse of life straight away, into the busyness of it and the tumult of it. I'd love you to read a part of Axiomatic. This is from the chapter called History Repeats Itself, yep. Or is it just History Repeats? I don't know. Looking at that axiom, this is primarily about a lawyer friend of yours.
Yeah, so History Repeats Itself. The kind of the main person in this chapter is a woman called Vanda. She is a community lawyer. She helps people. She works for people, in fact, that's how she would say, who we would think of as people with kind of entrenched disadvantage, you know, people who are born into poverty, people who were abused as children, people who are trapped in the circumstances of their life.
People are always going before the courts for one reason or another.
That's right. Yeah. It would be, you know, people who are on our streets, people who, you know, have addictions because they had the most horrendous childhood, not because of their failure as you know, the failure of character, whatever. And she, and so I met her, you know, 11 years ago, and I just followed her around. I went from court to court with her. I just watched her. I had, you know, countless conversations with her. I went to a funeral of one of the people who, you know, clients, and yet a person who was incredibly dear to her, and so forth. So she is a kind of a powerful presence in this particular section. But I'll just read the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And I have an accent. That morning, two men in my carriage lift their heads, two men in their 50s, in silky, understated ties. Then there is a little snap, like a red light camera going off, and even before the next stop gets announced, they're leaning into each other, laughing. How long has it been? Must be 40 years, give or take. What's been happening? They run through their classmates. Two cancers, one mid-chemo, one cannot hack chemo, a property development fraud, one guy just the other side of a protracted settlement with too many ex-wives. Stupid bastard. He and them deserve each other. A pause. Please don't tell me it's all there is. Fraud, cancer, bad marriage pics, being caught, extricating yourself, chance encounters on City Loop trains. Can you remember the last time life felt long or kind or like it was yours and mine? My phone vibrates, one time only for texts. Make sure you don't have scissors, nail files, anything sharp. It's Vanda. Thank you, Vanda. Shh. In front of me is time. Time is not a river. It is two strangers on a train whose briefcases touch as they hold each other, two men who'll never ride the same train again. I don't remember getting off or walking. Somehow I reached the courthouse doors on William Street, where my bag was screened, nothing sharp in it, and the structure that looked dull and huge on the outside, a building without qualities, was alive and brown inside with wrappers pulled off chocolate bars, doors slamming, others opening, kids in school uniforms who were not, as I'd guessed, witnesses to inexplicable suburban crimes, but legal studies students bored on a field trip. Several of the magistrates looked like Karl Heinrich Marx. In a lift, I stood next to a lawyer with the face of someone who sometimes forgets he hasn't yet seen it all. I looked at him. He looked at the crease of his hard-working pants. What is the court eight clerk wearing today? Orange jacket, there you go, bold choice for the setting. And what is court eight's loudest sound right now? My fine liner pen making notes about courtroom silence. Big silence in a room full of busy-looking people is jarring. Then the magistrate appears. Once he's seated, that silence is gone. And to a man on the stand whose second drink-driving offence is the day's first matter, he says, I cannot take your past away. And it is like some subterranean conversation underneath the one everybody can hear is flowing about how to be alive is to be caught in one web or another. I know your first offence was 20 years ago, but your past doesn't disappear. If police stop you, they'll test you, that's the magistrate. The magistrate means it's your last chance. Your cufflinks can't save you. The taxes you pay won't save you. He also means nothing is more human than the experience of feeling trapped. And everything is a trap, your past, family, genes, addictions, loneliness, that feeling that pretty much everyone else is galloping gaily ahead while you are crawling backwards like a lobster or lopsided baby.
Thank you. So much of this, of course, is a meditation about time and memory and all those things. It's a bit another axiom or truism that the Western concept of time and the Eastern one is a different thing. I know it's the problematic terms, Western, East, but just bear with me, please. The axiom or the idea behind that is that in the West, we're inclined to see time as a river or an arrow, a vector, essentially.
Yep.
Proceeds from here and flies through here and goes. In the East, so much of its philosophy is built on time as a wheel or a cycle or something. Is that something, a contrast that's played into your thinking with this book, Maria?
Yeah, and I think I talk about it in History Repeats Itself, because I think in the West, to use your problematic term, I think there is a kind of understanding of that cyclic nature, maybe not of time, but some things have been repeated, and I'm really interested in that. You know, history is repeated. You know, do we become our parents? You know, do we marry, our fathers or our mothers, etc.?
Is America going the way of ancient Rome?
America going, that's right, and will they be great? And togas, there is that kind of sense of repetition, but maybe not kind of directly mapped on the idea of time, but life as kind of repeating itself in some way. And I'm really interested in people, and I write about them who feel that they are bound to repeat their parents' destiny, that there is like a cross on their forehead. And that they can have their own life, and then the moment will come, and they will do exactly what their father or their mother did, 40 or 50 years ago.
I couldn't bear that thought. It's a terrible thought to live with.
And I actually spoke to multiple people who described this idea of kind of being marked, and one or two described that idea of a cross on the forehead.
And do you have that?
No, I don't. Absolutely not.
Are you grateful for that?
I'm very grateful for that. Yeah, yeah. So I think we understand, or we are pulled towards contemplation of things being cyclical, but of course there is this idea of the progression of time, and it's marches forward, and on some level I think it does. I mean, so maybe it's both.
Sometimes I wonder if it's actually got more to do with pre-industrial and industrial societies. Like my mother grew up in the country where everything's cyclical. Everything, the seasons are celebrated through the church and through the harvest and the winter months and all those things, and they're announced by how you go to church and how you go to school and what happens at every time of year, and time seems very cyclical. And once you get to the industrial era, it's a conveyor belt. It's a different metaphor.
Yeah, yeah,
metaphors are dangerous things when it comes to time.
Yeah, metaphors are huge. They totally shape how we think. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, speaking non-metaphorically, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Maria.
Thank you very
it's
much,
been a
Richard.
Great pleasure to have
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Maria Tumarkin.
Thank you.